Each week, American History TV sits in on a lecture with one of the nation's college professors. You can watch the classes here every Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern, and Sundays at 1 p.m. This week, history professor Chandra Manning looks at the Emancipation Proclamation and the escalation of the Civil War. Professor Manning examines how the inclusion of black soldiers helped deliver the Union victory. This hour and 15-minute class took place at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C.
All right, well, in class so far, as you know, we've considered the Union and the Confederacy together. We have talked about Lincoln and Davis, and we've compared their presidencies and the challenges that they each faced. We've compared how Northern and Southern publics expected the war to go and how the first year really defied expectations for everybody. We've compared ways in which the war really destabilized the basic pillars of society, both North and South, really fundamental things like gender roles in both societies. But the war evolved from a limited war to a hard war beginning in 1862. And once that happened, the war affected the Union and the Confederacy quite differently. So we're going to diverge for a couple of weeks, and we're going to talk about them one at a time, Union today and this week, and Confederacy next week, from now through the end of the war, and then when the war ends, we'll bring them back together again. But today, like I say, today's a Union Day, and the reason really has to do with today's subject, and that is the war's shift from a limited war to a hard war, because once the war does that, it really does start to affect the two societies quite differently. So today, like I say, I want to look at what shift to hard war meant for the Union. I want us to think about why it happened. What I'd like you to be asking yourself, though, is did a shift to hard war, and we'll talk about what that meant, did that constitute a revolution? This starts as a limited war. Do we have an actual revolution by 1862? And if we do, how and when and why did that happen? For whom? And what difference did that make to the way that the war played out? So those are our big questions for today. I want us to start by doing historians' favorite thing to do, and that is take something you think you know, something that's familiar, and make it strange all over again. I passed out the lyrics to the Battle Hymn of the Republic, which you have known since grade school, and you probably can't listen to without hearing the voice of Bart Simpson. But today I will change that. We're going to hear it twice. And the reason why we're going to hear it is because I think that in this quite famous song, we see signs of the Union's shift to a different kind of war. The song is written by Julia Ward Howe in 1862. My life quest is to find a recording of this song that I actually like, and I haven't done that yet. The song's a march. You're supposed to sort of parade down the street to it. And anytime anybody sings it, it sounds like a lullaby. So the reason why we hear it twice is we're going to listen to it the first time looking at the lyrics. Then we'll have our lecture today. At the end of class, I want us to return, and I'm going to play it for you as a regimental band would have played it. So it won't have lyrics, but you'll hear the right tempo. And at that point, I'd like us to talk about, now we've spent the past hour together thinking about this notion of hard war, where do you see that in Julia Ward Howe's song? But let's start today by hearing the words. Pretend people are singing these words much more robustly, but here are the words, at least.
Trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. He hath loosed the fateful lightning of his terrible swift sword. His proof is marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. On. I have seen him in the watchfires of 100 circling camps.
fiery gospel writ in burnished rolls of steel. As ye deal with my contemner, so with you my grace shall deal. Let the hero born of woman crush the serpent with his heel, since God is marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. His truth is marching on. He has sounded forth the trumpet that shall never call retreat. He is sifting out the hearts of men before his judgment seat. Oh, be swift, my soul, to answer him, be jubilant, my feet. Our God is marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. His truth is marching on. In the beauty of the lily, Christ was born across the sea, with a glory in his bosom that transfigures you and me. As he died to make men holy, let us die to make men free, while God is marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah.
In my other life, other aspect of my life, I am also a distance runner, and I sing to myself when I run, because then no one can hear me, and that's best. This is, by the way, if you are a distance runner, one of the greatest ever hill running songs, especially "Be swift, my soul, to answer him, be jubilant, my feet." You say that to yourself, and you are at the top of the hill before you know it. All right. We will return to that song, and we will hear a more stirring musical version at the end, but file it away in the back for a little bit here. And let's take a step back. I've said that today we're talking about the war shift from a limited war to a hard war, but it makes sense to make sure we know where we started from. So remind me, anybody, when we talk about a limited war, what did that mean? Hobie.
I guess not total war, so you're not taking out people's, like, you know, crops, like just burning and destroying everything. It's more you meet in battle and then go proceed like that.
Right. Tim, thanks.
Yeah, war of military maneuver, focusing on conflict between select military units, leaving the civilian population pretty much untouched. I think McClellan was the advocate of that, and we know how that turned out.
We'll remind ourselves today, but yes, McClellan is who springs to mind. The sort of underlying assumption behind limited warfare is this notion on the Union side of latent unionism, that if you're Lincoln, do you think most normal white Southerners are gung-ho for the Confederacy? No, you think they've been led astray by these feckless leaders, and that if we extend the hand of friendship to them, then good sense will rise to the surface and they'll come back into the Union. And so that's how Union military policy is formulated. It's conciliationism is the sort of textbook term it usually gets, but that's why. So what do soldiers do? They spend their time guarding civilians' crops and property, including their slave property, in the early part of the war. And again, the notion is, all that this is going to take is the armies are going to have to meet once or twice, one or two clashes, and then war is done and we can all go home. Well, that notion died in the Western theater earlier than it did in the Eastern theater. I didn't remind you to bring your maps today. You might not have them. If you do, this is a good map moment, but I brought one for you just in case. It's Shiloh in the West, where we usually date the beginning of the end for limited warfare. Shiloh, remember, happened in April of 1862, and U.S. Grant was there, and after Shiloh, he noted that up to the Battle of Shiloh, I, as well as thousands of other citizens, believed that the rebellion against the government would collapse suddenly, as soon as a decisive victory could be gained over any of its armies. But after Shiloh, I gave up all idea of saving the Union except by complete conquest. Now, by complete conquest, he meant the Union Army would have to knock out the Confederate Army, which, as we have seen, would be no mean feat. But he meant more than that. What he meant was that the will and the ability to wage war was clearly arising from more than just the Confederate Army. That will and ability resided in the Confederate public, in Southern people, too. So if you are going to wipe out the enemy's will and ability to wage war, you have to wipe it out where it lives. And that includes at all levels of society. And it also meant that winning the war would take more than a Northern army, a Union army. It would take the participation of all levels of Northern society, too. So when we talk about a shift from limited to hard war, that's what we're talking about. More than just setting fire to cornfields, we actually saw in Kate Stone in the first year, Confederates are lighting up cotton fields. That part starts pretty early. We mean a shift in thinking about who we're fighting and how we fight them and how we win this war. That shift did not happen all of a sudden on Tuesday afternoon at 3 o'clock. It happened at different places in different times. The West really was where the shift begins in the Western armies. And we see militarily, we see evidence of that shift in the West. When we talked about military campaigns in the West in 1862, the biggies were Corinth, which is a railroad junction. And remember, Corinth is nothing besides the railway junction. Kate Stone has never heard of the town, but there's a major conflict there. Or rivers. Why rivers? Shipping, transit, up and down. Not just to get supplies to armies, but that's also how civilians, that's how society subsists itself too, railroads and rivers. Those become the targets of the main Union military campaigns in 1862. So that's one way in which we see the beginnings of this hard war notion in the West in 1862. But we also see a shift to hard war in the sense of war impacting every single level of society in a number of other ways. One of them is that wherever the Union Army went, slaves flocked. Now, that's not the Army. That's not the Confederate Army. That's a whole other level of Confederate society that clearly sees itself as party to and involved in this conflict. By 1862, there were encampments of fugitive slaves, refugee slaves, all along the Mississippi River, wherever the Union Army was, and also along some other rivers, also at rail junctions like Corinth. What did these slaves do when they got there? Some of them built fortifications that allowed the Union Army to hold places like Nashville. Nashville goes to the Union Army quite early, but taking a city and keeping a city are two different things. How does the Union hold on to Nashville? Partly by building something called Fort Negley. Who builds Fort Negley? Slaves who have run to the Union Army. Former slaves cooked, they laundered, they essentially did daily tasks that freed up soldiers for other duties. That might not sound like a big deal, but remember, at the end of the day, this conflict's going to come down to manpower as much as anything. So freeing up manpower is a direct military contribution. Slaves, refugees, sometimes called contrabands, nursed sick soldiers. Again, that doesn't sound like that much, but remember when we talked about hospitals. What was the variable that most predicted mortality or not in military hospitals? Presence or absence of nursing. So contraband slaves, former slaves working as nurses matters. And another way in which slaves flocking to Union forces contribute to manpower, numerically smaller ways, but you know, exciting and dramatic ways nonetheless, are aiding a POW prisoner of war escapes. And I'll give you an example. A soldier named Hannibal Johnson, Maine. I looked for a Vermont one for you, Evan. The closest I could get for today was Maine. Sorry. But anyway, Hannibal and three other guys from his regiment in Maine, from Maine, were captured and were held in a Confederate prison in Columbia, South Carolina. And they got out of prison. That's, you know, good step number one. But it's 200 miles to the nearest Union lines, which are in Knoxville, Tennessee. Well, Mr. Hannibal Johnson of Maine has never been to Knoxville, Tennessee, or anywhere in the middle. How is he going to get there? How he gets there is that slaves sort of form almost this underground network that get him to Union Army lines. How do they know where Union Army lines? Because they're going back and forth between them. And so there are really concrete ways in which in 1862, level of society that you know white Union soldiers might not have thought was going to be too involved in this conflict is involved right from a very early date. And they're quite central by 1862. We can see hard war in another way, and that is wherever the Union Army goes, from 1862 on, slavery is destabilized. Now remember, we start the war with this notion of conciliation, protecting and guarding property, whatever that property might be. That's out the window in the West by 1862. And I'll give you an example. Remember that the Union Army takes New Orleans in 1862, right? So throughout Louisiana, slavery is now destabilized. Magnolia, Louisiana is not terribly close to New Orleans, but slaves in Magnolia, Louisiana know that the Union Army is in New Orleans. That is a chink in slaveholders' armor as they see it. And so the slaves on one plantation in Magnolia start to make new demands. We will work from this hour to this hour, but we get the afternoons in our own garden plots, and you can start paying us $10 a month. You can imagine the initial response of the owner and the overseer to this new idea. It's no. But then, a couple miles away, some slaves on a different plantation get hold of arms. They get them from Union Army raiders. And they threaten their own owner and overseer. So the Magnolia plantation slaves build a gallows as a warning sign. And what do you know? The owner and the overseer suddenly think wages and your own schedule are not such a bad idea. So the point is, here's a level of society quite outside the army, slaves on a plantation, for whom the war has already upset, destabilized, allowed them to kind of remake daily life in 1862. Now again, this is the West. It happens faster in the West than it does in the East. The East, limited warfare maintains a longer lease on life, number of reasons. One of them, as you point out, Tim, is General George McClellan. George McClellan remains a believer in limited warfare, in a conciliatory policy. These are our countrymen, and we extend our hand to them, and they come back. We don't crush their belongings. That's just not how we do this thing. Ethan.
Question, where sure. might Grant have gotten this sort of discovery of total war or kind of thought that would lead to it? Like, he certainly wasn't getting it from McClellan, and he probably wouldn't have gotten it from European strategy around the time either.
No, and where he said he got it, at least, was the battleground at Shiloh. He's also the guy who says that you could have walked from one end of the battleground to another and never stepped on ground because you would have hit a body all the way. And I think I think the very visceral experience of this war as a much more brutal clash than anticipated. But even that, even Shiloh didn't elicit the, I mean, that was a huge battle. If huge battles were going to do it, Shiloh should have, but we don't get anything like yep, you were right, game over. After Shiloh, we get renewed commitment. So that's part of it. Grant's also part of this campaign that he's part of these forces in the West who see these slaves flocking to Union lines, who see society really upended, whether that's what he had in mind or not. So I would say you're right. It isn't from Clausewitz. It's not from a textbook, although maybe he knew Clausewitz, who's the sort of origin of the line that war is politics by other means. Maybe he knew that stuff, but I think what did it for him was experience, was being there on the ground. And things just didn't go how anyone planned. In the East either, which leads to the question, why did McClellan hang on as long as he did? He's just a different guy. But things do look different in the East. Now remember that there are signs even in the East that this war is going to play out differently than anyone anticipated from quite early on. You remember Fort Monroe, May 23rd, 1861. So just weeks into the war, we already have three former slaves running to Union General Benjamin Butler, who refuses to return them to his owner. Now he doesn't decide for sure whether they're free or not, but he won't give them back. So we have a sign in the East as early as May 23rd of 1861. Things might not go exactly as planned. In South Carolina, in the Sea Islands of South Carolina, which are islands off the eastern coast of South Carolina, those fall to the Union in November of 1861. When that happens, most of the planters, white planters, leave, and most slaves stay. And so you have interactions between Union Army and enslaved people in those Sea Islands from November of 1861 on. And there are some great stories surrounding the Sea Islands occupation. There's a fellow named Robert Smalls, and you can see him up at the top here. Robert Smalls was a slave, but he was not a field hand. He was an enslaved man whose job was to pilot a steamer. Steamer is owned by Confederates, and this steamer, called the Planter, is running arms and ammunition among Confederate forts. Smalls, in 1861, I forget the exact date, early on, Smalls gets the idea that I know how to steer this boat, and there are some Union ships blockading the coast not too far away, and I can go pretty fast. I'm going to give it a shot. And so Smalls and his crew, also slaves, Smalls and the crew run the boat to Union lines, and it's accepted as a prize of war. He gets half the prize, and he continues to pilot boats for the Union Navy now for the rest of the war. So you have people like Robert Smalls who are saying from quite early on, even in the East, this is not such a limited war. I do not care what somebody like George McClellan says. May 13th, 1862, that's when Smalls did that. Well, as I keep saying, though, the Army of the Potomac is a little bit different. And the Army of the Potomac is the one everybody knows about, everybody cares about, everybody follows, because it's the Army of the Potomac that's trying to take Richmond. Huge symbolic value is also who's right outside, you know, Washington, D.C.'s door. And in the Army of the Potomac, McClellan holds sway. And so the conciliatory policy hangs on longer, but even there, just on the ground reality starts to get in the way. So the Peninsula Campaign, as you know, brought Union Army forces, the Army of the Potomac, within 4 miles or 6 miles, within sight of the gates of Richmond. Didn't take Richmond, we'll get to that, but they get pretty close. How do they get so close? Well, lots of things contribute. One factor, though, is spying, is intelligence of the lay of the land. Who on the peninsula knows the lay of the land who's sympathetic to the Union cause? Absolutely. So there are sort of slave spying networks going on even as early as the Peninsula Campaign. General Abner Doubleday served in the Army of the Potomac and did not actually invent baseball. In fact, did not care for baseball. But you can still think of him as an interesting fellow for this reason. He noted as early as 1862, part of the Peninsula Campaign, that slaves bring much valuable information which cannot be obtained from any other source. They make excellent guides and frequently have exposed the haunts of secessionist spies and traitors. So by the time that the Peninsula Campaign is in full swing, there's already some tension between McClellan and the men in his ranks, the guys who are benefiting from the strategic information brought in by slaves. There's tension between McClellan and the United States Congress, particularly Republicans in Congress, who hear what's going on the ground and who are losing faith in limited warfare. And you know that there's tension between McClellan and Lincoln because we read that correspondence between them a couple of weeks ago, and I think it's safe to say that the air was a little tense. Well, McClellan gets his way through the Peninsula Campaign. How does that campaign end, though? Right, they get within 4 or 6 miles, I forget which, but they do not take Richmond. When the campaign fails, McClellan is, at least for the time being, discredited. And so really we usually date the end of limited warfare and the transition to something new in the East there, with the failure of the Peninsula Campaign, so the summer of 1862. And so in summer of 1862, we start to see signs of a harder war in the East as well as the West. One of them is that call for 300,000 more troops. If this is going to be a longer, harder war, it will take more men. So we are coming, Father Abraham, 300,000 more is part of that campaign for more men. We also see McClellan replaced by General Henry Halleck. Now, Halleck is a very different guy. Sometimes known as Old Brains. This is his picture right here. And he has a very different idea about how war should be carried out. Rather than guarding civilian property, which is McClellan's method, Halleck's orders said that the property of active rebel sympathizers could be confiscated by the army because it's time that they, sympathizers, should begin to feel the presence of war. So Halleck, rather than McClellan, is sort of notice to all involved, things are going to change. And again, they don't change just like we suddenly start burning fields of hay. They change in ways that say that all of society and not just armies are in play here. And a clear example of war being something that happens not just on battlefields, not even just in violent confrontation, but at all levels of society is the famous Butler's Woman Order, General Orders No. 28, issued by General Benjamin Butler in New Orleans, Louisiana. Now, Butler keeps popping up in all kinds of places. He truly is one of the most opportunistic figures in the whole war. He's always good for a story, but here's what he does here. Union troops, as you know, occupied New Orleans in May of 1862. And the women of New Orleans were not pleased about this occupation, but also counted on the fact of their being women to make them immune, to make them untouchable, really. And so the women of New Orleans launch a sort of harassment campaign. They call soldiers names, they spit on them, they throw chamber pot contents on them. And, you know, their lives aren't in danger or anything, but Butler has had it. And why he's had it is he has had it with the notion that we have to do two things at once. We're supposed to be fighting this war, but also treating the people who hate us with utmost civility, and this is how it's turned. So make up your mind. We do one or the other, and I'll tell you how I make mine up. So Butler issues orders number 28, the woman order, the text of which says that any woman caught abusing or demeaning a Union soldier shall be regarded and held liable to be treated as a woman of the town plying her avocation. That means what you think it means. This order is an enormous insult. Why is this such a huge, I mean, it's giggle, giggle, funny. Why is it such a huge insult to issue an order like this? And that's precisely how he meant it. Joyce.
Well, it calls the women of New Orleans prostitutes, basically.
That's exactly what it does. And that is an insult to women, obviously. It's also a huge insult to Southern men, because who's supposed to be in charge of the behavior, the virtue in particular, of white Southern women, particularly women of the upper classes, which, as you can see, is who Butler has in mind here. Who's supposed to police them? Absolutely, white men. Oh, but you remember the story, the fight that we read, and these two women, one says something not very nice to another, and they don't fight, but their husbands. Exactly, because their husbands are the one who have clearly fallen down on the job because the women's behavior isn't up to snuff. It's exactly what Butler is doing. He's calling into question the honor of the men because they're not patrolling or policing their women. And that's exactly what he meant to do. The other thing that he meant to do was give notice that from now on, women of New Orleans, you are responsible for your own behavior in public. So the order is never acted on. I mean, it's not like suddenly these women are rounded up and arrested as prostitutes. Among other things, they just stop dumping their chamber pots. But what it does do and what it's meant to do is disrupt gender roles, to say to white Southern men that, you know, you're not so in charge anymore. There's a new boss in town, and it's us. And that's exactly what Butler meant to do. So I think Butler's order helps us be kind of precise about what this notion of hard war means, not just sort of indiscriminate slaughter. These women aren't rounded up. Henry Halleck, the guy who says, make civilians feel it, Henry Halleck's, you know, not a burn and torch everything guy either. He's an expert on international law. He, in fact, has written a treatise on international law. In 1862, he's good friends with a guy named Francis Lieber, who is a legal scholar. Lieber comes and visits Halleck while Halleck's still in the West, in Corinth, I think. And Halleck's urging, Lieber writes what becomes known as General Orders No. 100. If you've heard of it, it's as the Lieber Code. It's a code of conduct for how to treat noncombatants during wartime. It becomes the foundation for the Geneva Convention. This is the guy who also oversees the Eastern theater's transition to hard war. My point is, it's a more complicated concept than we at first think. And it involves more than just lots of extra burning and destruction. It means something more specific than, you know, suddenly the devil came down to Dixie. So what it really means is how people thought about how they prosecuted the Civil War shifted from pitched battles between armies to a much broader contest between two full societies. So if by the summer of 1862, the Union has recognized that the war can no longer be fought with elder stock squirts charged with rose water, where do we see that response? Other than the battlefield. If I'm telling you hard war means more than the battlefield, can we see a shift to hard war outside of the military theater? And the answer is yes. One of the places is in the, yeah, sorry, Tim.
In subsequent wars, World War I, II, etc., both sides are very good at demonizing and kind of dehumanizing the opponents. In the Civil War, was there a push to try to demonize or dehumanize the Northern soldiers, and then the North side to dehumanize Southern soldiers? If so, to what extent on a comparative basis?
I think that there's a degree of that throughout the history of human warfare. I mean, human beings don't generally like to do obvious harm and violence to each other. You've got to do something in your own mind to prosecute war. And time immemorial, a way to do it is to try and dehumanize or at least demonize the enemy. Now, the Union, it's complicated for the Union about the extent to which that's a good idea, because our whole goal here is to remind them that they're really still part of us. So that's a complicated prospect for the Union. And so what they tend to do is demonize slaveholders, but think that everybody else is still okay, except to the extent to which they're misled by the slaveholders, and then we need to straighten them back out. For the Confederacy, it's a more straightforward project. We don't want to be part of them, and so we even saw this with Jefferson Davis's message to to Mississippi legislature in December of 1862. That becomes a strategy, really, by 1862 for the Confederates, is to sort of portray the Union forces as vandal hordes. So in that sense, something like the Butler's Order plays right in. Look at that horrible beast. They call him Beast Butler. Clearly, we need to be separate from that guy.
Yeah. You're probably going to mention this when you talk about emancipation in a little bit, but how much of sort of the shift in the Northern public's view of emancipation came from them coming into contact with slavery? I mean, would a Northerner of, say, you know, the 1860s have really any contact with slavery beyond what he reads in the papers or something?
Depends on which Northerner and where he lives. But by and large, as we'll hear, you're right, as we will hear when we get into the Emancipation Proclamation, I think that the Northern public and the Union Army are not always on the exact same page where emancipation is concerned, and I think you put your finger on part of why. Because if you are a farm boy from Vermont, or if you make shoes in Massachusetts, or if you are from Illinois or Ohio, depending on which parts of Illinois or Ohio, it's quite possible you've never seen a real live slave. So to actually see slavery in situ, I actually think is an enormous factor in how Union soldiers will think about emancipation, particularly if the way in which you see them is, that's who's building your fortifications. Exactly. Exactly. Now, the opposite can happen sometimes, too, in that 500 of these slave refugees showed up. They're sick. They're starving. They're not. They feel like a burden to us. I've got a war to fight. I don't want to deal with them. So the opposite can also happen. But I think the shock of seeing slavery, though, shouldn't be underestimated. They talk about that over and over, how jarring they find the actual sight of it. Ethan.
Is it then a fair statement to say the army was more pro-emancipation than the rest of the society?
I think it gets there much faster. I do. I think so. And as we'll hear in a second, for quite pragmatic reasons, I got to fight this thing, and I think that's what we need to do to get rid of it. But I think that there is a time lag between when the army will support emancipation and when the home front will. Dan.
Although the slaves came over to the Union side and they had pretty important roles, were they treated nicely by the Union soldiers?
That's a big variance. That one varies a lot.
Right.
This is a tricky question in that, some of these camps that I'm talking about, called contraband camps, are, without question, they are sites of humanitarian crisis, and there's no way to sugarcoat that. Mortality rates in a place like, we haven't gotten to Vicksburg yet because it hasn't fallen, but there will be a big camp at Vicksburg, for example. The mortality rates there are so astonishing that one aid worker says, if you wanted to kill slaves, you couldn't have found a better way to do it. So in some places, they are absolutely dreadful. So what do we make of that? How do we think about that? Are these camps, are the places where Union soldiers and slaves come into contact a sort of wonderful sites of refuge? No. But they're not outright, they're not sort of conscious attempts to kill off the population, which some people have said either. Here's how I see it. When's the Red Cross come into existence?
Some more.
Yeah, and the U.S. isn't part of it till much later. The Army's not a humanitarian organization, and there's not world precedent yet. For what, I mean, the first, I've been thinking about this question a lot lately, which is why this answer is way too long, but I've been trying to think about, so if you're Lieber, for example, writing this code, what do you have in world history to look at for your precedent for what we would call war refugees? And I can't really think of anything. I mean, World War I and Flanders and all of that, the notion of refugees will become, there will be precedent, there will be something to look to. Part of the Union Army's problem is it doesn't know what to do. There are hundreds and later thousands of these slave refugees, and it's not ready, and it doesn't know what to do. And the Army is filled up with individuals who have widely varying, whatever they think about getting rid of slavery as a war aim or whatever, they have widely varying attitudes towards Black people as people. And some of them are there's no sugarcoating, they're horrible. So absolutely, mistreatment and abuse happen. Absolutely, the death rates are terrible and they are awful. But they're at the exact same time and places, though, these are the exact same places where you begin to see people revisiting assumptions and changing their minds. So these camps really don't let us have an easy way out either way. Like, we can't turn them into it's a small world after all, wonderful moments. But we also do a disservice to the complicated process of emancipation and racial attitudes and all that if we demonize them either. And I think they're important because I think there's something about war in that. I really do. Yeah, Joyce.
Can you draw a parallel between the populace of the North not having seen very many Black people, and the concern in the North that what are we going to do with all these slaves once they are liberated? We can't have them among us. But meanwhile, the contrast is the Union Army does have them with them. So isn't it true usually that what you can think up is always worse than what you are actually experiencing? And so is that a factor in these, all these crazy schemes to colonize Negroes in the West or Guatemala or Mexico or Liberia or blah, blah, blah. I mean, it's all a scheme to get rid of them, isn't it?
Well, yeah, what they are, I think, are attempts to separate out two things, and that is slavery, which we think is a problem and we want it to go away because, look, it's brought this huge war. But that's quite separate from what about these 4 million people who have been enslaved, and white Northerners are not in any big rush, by and large, to elevate these people to full citizenship status either. And so what they want to do is answer the one question and not deal with the other. And so proponents of colonization generally are people who want to answer the emancipation question, but they don't want to deal with what comes next. And so there are all sorts of schemes sort of touted. None of them really come to much, but there are all sorts of schemes that fly both before and even during the war. But we have to get to emancipation first, so we better get there, or we're still going to be stuck in the camps. And as I've told you, the mortality is terrible, so we got to get out of the camps. What is Congress up to, though? I do want to spend a couple minutes on trying to convince you of this notion that a harder war, a shift to war in earnest, means war not just on the battlefield; it means war other places too. And Congress, I think, recognizes that. In the 37th Congress, second session. And I've always thought that if there had not been a war going on, like, everybody would know about this Congress, because it would have been the most amazingly productive Congress in the history of Congresses. Just the notion of Congress would get this much done in a single session would drop all of our jaws. But of course, there's war going on. That's more exciting. So we know more about that. What does this Congress do? This Congress passes the Homestead Act. Homestead Act gives 160 acres of land free, except for a $5 filing fee, of public land, usually in the West, to any head of household. Listen to that. Head of household. Did I say male? Nope. Did I say citizen? Nope. Did I say white? Nope. So the Homestead Act is truly radical. Now, there are all kinds of problems with it, and who's on that land and all that kind of stuff. There are enormous problems with it that will become evident when the war is over. But it's a radical notion about who, it's a radical act. Unless, sorry, Evan.
Sorry, could you just repeat what you, a little bit before that, just on the specifics?
Right, 160 acres of land, what's called a quarter section. So 160 acres of land. Free of charge except for a $5 filing fee to any head of household, that could be male, it could be female, it might be citizen, it might be immigrant, it could be white, it could be black. And that's yours if you can live on it and improve it, which means build a structure for 5 years. And so you pay the filing fee, but not the cost of the land. You got to get yourself there. Living there for 5 years is no small feat. That's what I mean by all. And there are some other people who think this land belongs to them, namely Native Americans. So there are all kinds of problems with it. But just the idea that you can get this act passed, that is essentially giving United States land to people who we weren't paying a lot of attention to before this war started, is remarkable. Same Congress gets the Morrill Land Grant College Act passed. If you live in a state that has more than one public university and the second one is something state, that probably came into existence thanks to the Morrill Land Grant College Act. Morrill Land Grant College Act allowed for the sale of certain public lands, the revenue of which would fund a public university, specifically or especially for agricultural and technology education and research, but public universities in the individual states. This Congress passed the Transcontinental Railroad Act. A sort of our fancy way of talking about it now would probably be a public-private partnership. But essentially, the U.S. Congress is going to subsidize the construction of a railroad all the way to the Pacific Coast. This Congress established the Department of Agriculture. No such thing until this Congress. This Congress passed the Legal Tender Act. Greenbacks, bills, money that could be recognized as money. We've talked about how crazy finances are, North and South, before the war. If you're a bank and you want to print your own money, you can do it, whether anyone takes it or not, kind of up to them. Legal Tender Act creates these bills, and these are legal tender anywhere. We take it for granted. If I show you a dollar bill and I'm, you know, live here in Washington, D.C., and you live in California, that dollar bill should mean the same to both of us. We take that for granted. This is why we take that for granted. Legal Tender Act, 37th Congress, second session. 37th Congress, second session, you liked them, you're not going to in a minute. This is also the Congress that first brings you the income tax. Doesn't last, it goes away after the war, and as you know, revives later. But it is the first time we get an income tax. It's 3% on incomes of $600 to $10,000 per year, 5% on incomes of $10,000 or greater. That higher bracket would later go up to a 10% bracket. That's quite a lot. But this is also the same Congress that begins to take truly noticeable steps against the institution of slavery. Now, as we've said, Dan, you brought up and we've talked about before, there are people on the ground in the Union Army and certainly slaves themselves who've been urging their elected officials at home to take these steps earlier. This Congress starts to take the steps. Yeah.
What did the Congress look like? Who was the leadership and, you know, if it were like CNN today, what would they be talking about?
Right. Congress, why can they get all this? This is part of why they can get so much done. Who's not in Congress? Yeah.
Today's Republican Party is not there.
The southern states are not there. The northern states are there, and there are still Democrats in Congress, but it's a Republican-dominated Congress. Unmanageable without secession. The Democrats themselves, remember, after 1862 on, are kind of internally divided between the War Democrats and the Peace Democrats. So Lincoln's party has a much freer reign than, it's why they can get so much done. Certainly why they can get as much done on slavery as they do. Now, so far, the policy towards slavery has been at the kindest, or kindest thing we can say, it would be ambiguous. There's a sort of one step forward, one step back, three steps sideways kind of characteristic to it up to this point. We saw Butler at Fort Monroe in May say, I'm not giving you your slaves back. I confiscate them as contraband of war, which, as we said, leaves open all kinds of questions, doesn't actually free the slaves, but also gets them out of their owner's hands. Slaves hear it as freedom, and they start going to Fortress Monroe. That's early. That's May of 1861. But in that same year, August of 1861, General Fremont in the Western Theater in Missouri passes an edict that says, I am emancipating all the slaves of rebel owners. And that is overturned. Now, there are all kinds of reasons for that to be overturned. Missouri is still in the Union. Virginia was not. Nonetheless, if you are a soldier, if you are a slave, if you're any onlooker, there's a clear contradiction in Army policy in 1861. Union Army encampments, as we've seen, are reliant on black labor. And yet we've got Henry Halleck in November of 1861 issuing General Orders Number 3, which states that no fugitive slaves will hereafter be permitted to enter the lines of any camp or of any forces on the march, and that any now within such lines should be immediately excluded therefrom. So we have November of 1861, Henry Halleck saying all these black laborers, all these former slaves, they're not supposed to be there. Again, contradiction, ambiguity, because the order is sort of recognized in the breach more than the practice. It drives camps crazy. What are we going to do? You can't turf them out. What will we do? But there it is. It's a conundrum. And it's a conundrum that drives soldiers crazy. So you have a Wisconsin guy writing to his hometown newspaper in the hopes his elected official will read it, saying, "On this, the government's policy makes no more sense than the ancient oracle. Lincoln will say one thing to Congress, will say another thing to appease the border states, and in the army, every general does just what he pleases." As far as he was concerned, and he's telling his readers at home, his fellow soldiers were concerned, the only policy that made sense was direct action against slavery, because that's the only way to win the war. Well, the 37th Congress, second session, does begin to take direct action. Most important, well, the first thing they do, January of 1862, is they overturn the Crittenden Resolutions. Crittenden Resolutions had been passed in the very first weeks of the war, and in those resolutions, you probably remember, Congress had said, "We're just about Union, we're not going to touch slavery." January of 1862, Congress overturns those resolutions, says, "We don't mean it anymore." March of 1862, Congress answers that General Orders Number 3 by saying, "No army does not return fugitive slaves." There is a policy now, Union Army does not return fugitive slaves. Also, as of March 1862, the Union Army will not guard civilian property. Congress also grants diplomatic recognition to the republics of Haiti and Liberia, black nations that had existed obviously before that, but had never been granted diplomatic recognition by the United States. In April of 1862, Congress abolished slavery in the District of Columbia, also opened public schools to black children. So we see in the beginning, and we see in the first quarter, I guess, of 1862, first third of 1862, some definite motion against slavery on the part of Congress. Now, there are still cautionary notes. We still have General George McClellan saying, "Any declaration of radical views, especially on the slavery question, will rapidly disintegrate these armies." But McClellan by now is seriously out of step, and almost everybody except McClellan knows it. Well, almost everybody in the army, not everybody at home. And Congress is copping on too. So in July 17th of 1862, Congress passed the Second Confiscation Act. Second Confiscation Act is important because the first Confiscation Act, remember, had said that it had essentially made a law out of Butler's policy, that any slaves actively used in support of the rebellion were confiscated from their owners. They weren't their owners' property anymore, but it didn't answer their status question. It didn't say, are they property of the federal government or are they free? It didn't say. The Second Confiscation Act does say, July 17th, 1862, not only can slaves being used in active support of the rebellion be confiscated, any slave of any disloyal owner can. So whether or not you were using that slave to build a ditch, if you support the Confederacy, the slave can be confiscated and freed. Second Confiscation Act says freed. It's a big step. In July of 1862, Lincoln aggressively lobbied the delegation of congressmen from the border states to adopt gradual emancipation plans within their state legislatures. So he goes to Delaware, well, the delegations from Delaware, Missouri, Maryland, and Kentucky, and says, "Here is a plan. You will have federal support. We will help reimburse you even, but you need to get your state legislatures to pass it." All the delegations turn him down. And he presents this plan to them on July 12th. They turn him down on July 13th. Second Confiscation Act, July 17th. July 23rd of 1862, Lincoln meets with his cabinet. What does he show them in this meeting of July 23rd, 1862? "Got something up my sleeve." And what is it? It's the Emancipation Proclamation. Exactly. Famously, William Seward convinces Lincoln that he needs to wait until a Union victory as the moment for unrolling the Emancipation Proclamation so that it not look like a desperate gasp. And Lincoln agrees. Which sounded like a good idea at the time, but as you know, Union victories were sort of slow in coming in 1862. Summer and early fall of 1862 were looking particularly discouraging. Confederate armies were preparing for northern incursions in both Ohio and even Pennsylvania in the summer of 62. The Confederate Army was playing havoc with Union supply lines in the West, particularly in Tennessee. In Virginia, the news just stayed bad for the Union. Army of the Potomac kept winning to the Army, or kept winning, they wish, kept losing to the Army of Northern Virginia at places like Cedar Mountain and Second Manassas or Second Bull Run at places like Chantilly. In fact, they lost enough that Lincoln got desperate enough to give McClellan another chance. So Lincoln restored McClellan to command, primarily to ward off invasion of Pennsylvania, which looked imminent in the summer of 1862. On September 5th, an aide discovered copies of General Robert E. Lee's orders in Maryland, and those orders revealed that Confederate forces were divided. This would seem to be the golden moment to strike. Well, how? What do you know about McClellan?
He has the slows.
He has the slows, exactly, and they were acute. In September of 1862, he delayed. Lee was able to reunite his forces on the banks of Antietam Creek in Maryland, outside a town called Sharpsburg, and the armies met there on September 17th of 1862. On that day, 6,000 soldiers are killed, and 17,000 were wounded, missing prisoners, a total of 23,000 casualties in a single day. That battle retains the dubious distinction of being the bloodiest battle in terms of American lives lost in a single day in U.S. history. But the Confederate invasion goes back to Virginia. So if you're Lincoln and you're desperate for a victory, this will work, because Union forces hold the field of battle at the end of the day, textbook victory. But more important, this invasion has been repelled. And so it's a victory in that sense, or at least it will do. And so on September 22nd of 1862, Lincoln issued the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation, which said that as of January 1st, 1863, the slaves of any areas still in rebellion against the government of the United States would be henceforth and forever free. The preliminary proclamation also, Joyce, in response to your earlier point, also suggests voluntary colonization as a possible sort of answer to what might we do next. It doesn't mandate, but it suggests it as a possible answer. January 1st of 1863, the final proclamation does, in fact, follow up all slaves in areas still in rebellion, with a few sort of exceptions here and there. But in general, slaves in areas in rebellion are free as of January 1st. There's no mention of colonization in the final proclamation. And the final proclamation explicitly endorsed the arming of black Union soldiers. Now, I want to talk about this document, the Emancipation Proclamation, just for a minute. We'll do its effects and all that. But I think few documents in American history have had quite as strange a career as the Emancipation Proclamation. Depending on who and when you ask, this single piece of paper either destroyed slavery with the stroke of a pen, or it was the most useless document ever that didn't free a single slave and has all the moral grandeur of a Bill of Lading. There's quite a bit of territory between those two interpretations. Did you have a question, Ethan?
No.
So how do we assess? And not to mention there is now an enormous mythology grown up around the Emancipation Proclamation. I have to admit, my oldest son has a placemat with the Emancipation Proclamation. So how can we make judicious sense of the significance of this document? Well, in many ways, it was a limited document. Emancipation was claimed as a war power that could apply only to areas in rebellion. So what's exempted? Well, the border states. Four states in the Union still legally recognize slavery. Those places are not affected because they are not in rebellion. So it's, you know, practically limited where it, in terms of where it applies. It's also limited in the sense that it describes emancipation in very instrumental, pragmatic terms. Emancipation is a military necessity as opposed to a moral gesture, as opposed to a righting of wrongs. The final proclamation does mention the matter of justice, but by and large, it's a very utilitarian document. So I think we need to acknowledge that it is limited. It doesn't single-handedly free 4 million people. And yet I still think it's important, and there are reasons why I think that. I think the proclamation did change, in obvious ways, the character of the war. I think it's not an accident we see it in 1862, because after the proclamation, it's impossible to see the war as limited. Any union coming after this proclamation is going to be a union without slavery, and the union had slavery in 1861. Remember that Lincoln's early political fame grew from a speech in which he said that the United States could not endure half slave or half free. It would become one thing or the other. The Emancipation Proclamation pretty clearly points to which way. Finally, the Union Army would enforce the Emancipation Proclamation, and this one does matter a lot, I think, because it made the Union Army, in effect, what so many of its members had been trying to be for some time, and that is a bludgeon against slavery wherever it went. So I think that the best way to think about the proclamation is certainly not as the single magic bullet that did away with the institution of slavery in one fell swoop, but also not as a sort of begrudging, worthless gesture. I think the best way to think about it really is as one step, but one important step in a very long and complicated process of destroying what was a very powerful institution. No single document could do it in one fell swoop. This one helped, it didn't do all of it. That's what I think we will talk about. It's one of the things we talk about on Friday is what do you guys think? And I expect robust disagreement with me on that score. Don't disappoint me. What did people think at the time, though? That's important. And what they thought really varied. The Union home front was very divided on the measure. There certainly was some hostility to the Emancipation Proclamation, especially among the peace Democrats. They didn't want this war to begin with, certainly not a war that was going to change the world as they knew it. There's a lot of hostility on their part to the Emancipation Proclamation. There's a lot of hostility on the part of just ordinary white Northerners who just don't know what should come next. Although I think that we have overestimated some of the hostility to the proclamation itself. I think we've conflated, and this again goes to your question, Joyce. So the proclamation comes out, but also in the summer of 1862 and early fall, the Union Army starts at government expense shipping loads of slave refugees up the Mississippi River into Midwestern communities, just in time for the midterm elections of 1862. Now, Lincoln is usually a pretty politically astute guy. It's rare he makes a political misstep. That kind of is one in terms of timing, because what that does is it excites a whole lot of hostility to the idea of these refugees coming into our communities, and people are up in arms about that. That may or may not be the same thing as opposing the Emancipation Proclamation, but nonetheless, there's certainly a divided Northern Union public. Among Union soldiers, of course, there's some resistance and opposition. By and large, what you see is, well, it's about time. This is what we've been telling you for some time now, that the only way we're going to win this thing is to take direct action against slavery. Confederate soldiers, you mostly get a "see, we told you so." That's what Lincoln's been up to since the very beginning. Now they're finally showing their hand. That's how people respond at the time. The proclamation is a military measure, which means a couple of things. It means, first of all, there will be no authority for emancipation in time of peace. It only applies in time of war. And that is why an amendment to the United States Constitution becomes a focus for Lincoln and for the Republican Party so soon after the passage of the emancipation. If it's going to last into peacetime, you need something else, and it'll take an amendment. But it also means the other sort of important thing to remember about this as a military measure is it means nothing unless the Union wins. If the Confederacy wins, then the proclamation is exactly what some Confederate leaders called it, and that is as effective as the Pope's bull against the comet. You know, Lincoln can say what he likes. He doesn't have any control over us. Well, you know from our discussion last week that and earlier today that a factor in winning was going to be manpower. Who could keep armies in the field the longest? And by 1862, everybody's having a harder time at that. You know that the Confederates had a draft in April 1862. The Union hasn't had to draft yet, but it's having a much harder time than it did April 1861 getting men to volunteer. There is one pool of willing recruits, however, that the Union forces have not yet tapped. And 1862 and into 1863 is the time in which this pool will be tapped. And here's another indication, I think, we have that we've got something, we don't have limited war going on here. We have a much harder war. We have something more fundamental, a deeper change than anyone had anticipated. And that is tapping the pool of black soldiers available to the Union. Now, black men had attempted to enlist in the Union Army from the outset in 1861. We read Alfred Green's speech in Philadelphia last week. Alfred Green is a prominent black Philadelphian who assumes that black men will be enlisting in 1861, and he gives a speech likening their struggle to that of the Patriots in the Revolution. So imagine his surprise and everybody he talked to that day when, at first, the Union Army rebuffs, does not take black soldiers, at least not officially. There are a couple of ways. There are some individual isolated cases of black individuals who do enlist in white units and fight. You guys read Cyrus. Do you remember Cyrus Boyd? I had you read Cyrus Boyd was an Iowa soldier, and I had you read his account of Shiloh. At Shiloh, he saw the elephant, and it really sort of woke him up to war is all about. Well, in his regiment, there was a soldier named Thomas Jeffries. And Thomas Jeffries, as it turns out, this isn't in the regimental, if you go on the rolls, you won't find this. But in the back of Cyrus Boyd's diary, he has a little cast of characters. He talks a little teeny tiny biographical sketch of everybody in his regiment, including Thomas Jeffries. Well, Thomas Jeffries, as it turns out, was a local black man. He just enlisted in this white regiment. And he faced a lot of resistance at first. Some people thought it was a good idea. Some people didn't. He turns out to be a good soldier. He is accepted and then dies of typhus. My point about Jeffries, pardon? Yeah, I know, exactly. I'd love to tell you this is a happy story. It's really not. But what it does say is that there's a clear attempt from the beginning on the part of black men to serve in the Union Army. And they do serve in the Union Navy and the Merchant Marine. There's always black service in both of those. But to be rebuffed from the Army officially is still enormously significant. And that's the that's the official Army line, really, for more than a year for the beginning of the war. The bar was officially lifted against black enlistment in the Union Army by the Militia Act of July 1862. Well, it's sort of lifted. It's lifted in that the Militia Act allows the president to accept offers of service of black men in any capacity which he may see fit. It doesn't explicitly say as soldiers, and in fact, most people read it as sort of normalizing the black army laborer phenomenon. Figuring as sort of equalizing how we're going to pay for contraband labor is how most people see that. But Lincoln, in retrospect, sees it as a ha. Go ahead, Tim.
Wasn't that the justification in the Militia Act for setting a lower wage
for
black soldiers because it was anticipated, or that at least was the justification?
Yes, we're getting there to the many ways in which they will face discrimination. But yeah, the Militia Act is exactly how the pay differential the case that's tried to be made for the pay differential. So this Militia Act will matter for a lot of reasons. The final Emancipation Proclamation of July of 1863 explicitly endorses black soldiers. There are already two regiments, units in the field, one in Kansas, one in South Carolina. But it's really the Emancipation Proclamation that makes clear that this is going to be official Union policy now. We've got a couple questions on our hands. We should have a great new pool of recruits. But would black men enlist? Yeah, Ethan.
Okay.
Would black men enlist? Now, there's a pretty wide swath of white opinion which says, no, they're all cowards, they'll never enlist. We can discount that, quite obviously. What we need to think about for a moment, though, is what about some free northern black opposition? I mean, why would you, if you were a black man in 1863, want to enlist in the Union Army. You tried in 1861. They said, no, this is a white man's war. The United States government has legalized slavery its entire existence. There's no state where you're treated equally. You've been listening to all this rhetoric about a white man's war. The black families tended to be closer to the economic margins than white families. Your family will probably face hardship while you're away, and you might be discriminated against. Why would you want to enlist? And some prominent black Northerners say don't, for all those reasons. And my point here is we shouldn't shouldn't talk about white opinion, black opinion. There are divisions even among the groups we think of as unified. At the end of the day, though, many prominent black Northerners did encourage enlistment, did come out in favor of enlistment, most notably Frederick Douglass. Frederick Douglass worked very hard as a recruiter among black soldiers. Men of color to arms is the poster up there. That's Douglass's line. And his notion is, you put those brass letters, U.S., on a black man, and there is no question that not only has he gained freedom, but also citizenship. So for Douglass and for people who think like him, Army service is a very important, not just blow against slavery, it's clearly that, but it's a blow on behalf of black equality, too. Which leads us to the question, okay, so some of them, clearly a lot of them, and I'll tell you how many in a minute, do enlist, and there are a couple of reasons why. Some black recruits talk in terms like white recruits do. They talk about the revolution and saving the legacy of the founders for free government and representative government. So it's not like white soldiers and black soldiers are speaking totally different languages. There are points of congruence. But the war as a crusade against slavery is certainly much less of a complicated or problematic issue for black soldiers than for white soldiers. And as Douglass in his U.S. Brass Letters of U.S. indicate, black soldiers are far more likely than white soldiers to talk about service as a road to a way to obtain the full privileges and rights of U.S. citizenship. You fight for a country, it owes you something in return. But there's another way in which black soldiers talk about Union Army service, which we need to think about for a minute, because it sounds a little odd to us. Black soldiers talk about fighting for the manhood of the race. And I think they mean a couple of things when they talk about that. And I think one is their own masculine identity, recognition of themselves as adult black men. Think for a minute back to the very beginning of class when we talked about how 19th century Americans think about or define manhood. Do you remember what any of the qualities that defined manhood were? I'm really asking you to go way back.
Property, control, there's two. I'll let everybody else do the rest.
He started you off.
Having a family to take care of.
Caring for a family, owning property sometimes, being able to control oneself, control people who depended upon you. Courage is another one. Free will is another one. Each of these things, I think you'll notice, is impossible under the institution of slavery, right? And in fact, one of the sort of reasons why slavery rankles is because, and there's a lot of reasons, but one of them is because it systematically denies to black men the very markers that white people accord with manhood. So white people then turn around and say, see, they're not really men. So there's this horrible sort of circular logic going on here. Soldiering is a chance to break this vicious circle. As a soldier, you can demonstrate courage. As a soldier, you'll be paid. You have the chance to perhaps, whether you'll accumulate property or not, that's paid to you. Soldiering is a free and independent choice. You decide to do that. Someone doesn't do that for you. Soldiering can also be a way of taking care of your family in a couple of ways. One is that black enlistment in the Union Army will automatically free the members of the black man's family. They become freed as well as him. Now, some of them, of course, already were under the terms of the Emancipation Proclamation or the Confiscation Act. But where aren't people free yet? Right, so this is a really important key for soldiers from the border states. Because if you are a slave in Missouri, for example, here's a way for your family to get free. And one of my favorite examples of soldiering as a way of taking care of one's family comes from a Missouri slave, actually. And his name is Spotswood Rice. Joins the Union Army, and he finds out that his regiment is going to be going through the neighborhood of a woman who still owns his daughters. And the owner's name is Miss Kitty. And he's tried to actually purchase his daughters from Miss Kitty to get them free. She wouldn't sell. So he writes her a letter when he finds out that his regiment's going through her part of Missouri. And he tells her, we're coming through and I am taking my children and you cannot stop me because you will burn in hell if you try and prevent a man from taking care of his family. So the link for Rice between soldiering and manhood is pretty explicit in that letter. But there's another thing I think that black soldiers sometimes mean when they talk about manhood of the race. I think sometimes they also mean recognition of the full humanity of all slaves, of all black people. I don't think, in other words, they see this as just about men. I think they see this about black women, about black children, that that by battling against an institution that keeps Southern blacks in bondage, black men see themselves as smashing the chains of prejudice, of dehumanization that have kept all slaves, and not just slave men, in bondage. And that's a pretty powerful motivator. And they enlist in pretty impressive numbers. In total, about 180,000 black men serve in the Union Army. They form 152 regiments. They make up 10% of the Union Army. They make up only 1.2% of the Northern population, but 10% of the Union Army. The numbers, 34,000 of them were free black Northerners. The rest were escaped slaves. They fought in 30 major battles, 449 engagements. Their death rate was 1 out of 3. They have a higher death rate than white soldiers do. They were right to worry about discrimination. They did face it. They fought in segregated units with worse equipment. They had worse duty, digging ditches and the like, for less pay at first, for precisely the reason Tim is bringing up. Initially, they're paid under the terms of the Militia Act, which, remember, most people saw as being about army laborers. And the Militia Act set pay at $10 a month. Soldiers received $13 a month. There is massive activism on this score throughout the black ranks, and it's equalized. Congress equalizes black soldier pay in 1864 and eventually makes it retroactive. So I think that the black soldier pay controversy is that's a victory. That one is hard to see as anything other than black men really, really using the war as an opportunity to set a goal to gain it. And black soldiering finally matters in terms of eroding white prejudice. To think slavery is a problem we need to get rid of, as we've noted, is one thing. Thinking that black people deserve equal rights or are, you know, fully equal with whites is something entirely different. I will not say that black soldiering leaps that, you know, totally squares that circle. It doesn't. But it does make a dent in white Northerners' preconceptions. An Illinois soldier fought with black soldiers at the Battle of Milliken's Bend in June of 1863 and wrote home, "I never more wish to hear the expression, 'the Negroes won't fight.' Come with me 100 yards from where I sit, and I can show you the wounds that cover the bodies of as brave, loyal, and patriotic soldiers as ever drew bead on a rebel. They fought and died defending the cause that we revere." Fort Wagner in the East, if you've seen Glory, it's about the attack on Fort Wagner, Massachusetts 54th, has the same effect for Eastern audiences. But I think black soldiers, for our purposes, also make very obvious and unavoidable the linkage between the Union Army, war, violence, and the end of slavery. They remind us that emancipation happened at gunpoint. It took a cast of thousands. It took a president. It took an army. It took individual slave men and women to end slavery, and it took a war. Those processes, I think, are pretty closely linked. Recall that slavery had been founded in and depended on violence. It lived by the sword. I think the year 1862 tells us that it also died by the sword, and that's part of what we're talking about when we talk about hard war. So I want to return again to this Battle Hymn of the Republic. This time, we'll play in the background the instrumental version so you can talk at the same time. This instrumental version is, they're people now, they're not real soldiers, obviously, but it's a regimental band playing the song as a regimental band would have played it, so you get the tempo a little bit. If you have those lyrics, bring them out, and let's revisit this song and see what you see in it that tells you hard war. And then this is it for the day. Come on. All right, any questions while I try and make this work? Yeah.
Just like one, you asked, you know, where do we see it in the times? I really see it as he died to make men holy, let us die to make men free. And that sort of association of Christ imagery with emancipation, I mean, we've sort of seen it before, and you talked about how religious leaders are more apt to to be abolitionists in the North just because they consider it kind of a moral, more of a moral sin. But that image association, I think, is really sort of interesting to think about.
And that was one of my gripes with the other version that we heard, is when it gets to that, as he died to make men holy, let us die to make men free, it gets very sing-songy.
Well, they take out the instrumental, so it's just like, oh, nice acapella sing-song.
Yeah, and I think you're right. I think that's some hard stuff there.
Yeah.
That's stirring.
Sure.
Thank you. Yeah.
In the Union, was there this great disparity between the private today and Captain's Bay, as there was in the Confederacy?
Everywhere there's a pretty big disparity.
Okay, yeah. Because it's in Kate Stone, I believe. And then in one of the readings.
Yeah, the James Brand Skim
reading.
Yes.
Yeah, I was pretty shocked about that. $200 to $11?
I will be honest, I don't remember if the disparity is exactly dollar for dollar.
Right.
It's noticeable, though.
Okay.
It's noticeable. So that's more what it would have sounded like. The tune is, does anyone know what the tune that the battle hymn was set to was?
John Brown's Body.
John Brown's Body. What do people think about John? What do normal white Northerners think about John Brown in 1859?
Crazy.
So marching to that tune in 1862, 1863 itself, I think, tells us something. Anything else you see in the lyrics or any sort of observations where you see hard war?
Well, the point that was just brought up, the linkage between the punishing Steele and the grace of God, you know, just woven together all the way through the lyrics. So,
yes, yeah, there's not a lot of conciliation in these lyrics. Yeah.
There's a consistent theme of stomping on things. Stomping up, trampling the grapes, crush the serpent with his heel, things like that. So it's kind of really like putting his foot down on, kind of boot on the neck kind of feel to it.
The extended hand is not what we see here. We see the crushing heel.
Yeah.
All right, any last parting thoughts? If not, thanks very much. I will see you Friday. We will talk about, among other things, how slavery ended in the United States. So thanks a lot.
Day reminded me of experimented in my dear sister class now a long time ago when my teacher.
Next week on Lectures in History, author Michael Barone is a guest lecturer at the Citadel Military College in Charleston, South Carolina. Mr. Barone talks about Alexis de Tocqueville and conservative conceptions of liberty, equality, and community. Join us each Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern, and Sundays at 1 p.m. for classroom lectures from across the country on different topics and eras of American history. Lectures in History are also available as podcasts. Visit our website at cspan.org/history/podcasts or download them from iTunes.